Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning program, heard exclusively here on WEEB. This is Taking Aim, and I am Steve Woodward. Thank you for joining us once again. We, of course, have a content-laden roster of topics to address with you this morning, and we're going to get right to it, but not before we pay homage to our beloved sponsor, The Marketplace. Restaurant and catering since 1980, your go-to for a fabulous breakfast destination as well as lunch. And now, Thursdays through Saturday, I believe, dinner is served at the Marketplace between the hours of 4 and 8 p.m. That actually launched just this past week. And go over and see Luke and the gang for dinner starting at 4 p.m. And again, that will kick off on Wednesdays? Yeah, I guess it's Wednesday through Friday, 4 to 8 p.m. The Marketplace since 1980. I want to remind you that coming up, I'm going to guarantee inspiration on this program today as we will be chatting with two members of a local Club America chapter. Now, what is Club America? It is the high school equivalent of Turning Point USA on the college campuses. So Charlie Kirk, of course, built his organization with Turning Point USA spreading across the college campuses to recruit young men and women to embrace the Constitution and the freedoms of America that we much protect from one generation to the next. Had a Joe Biden moment there. And from that, the offshoot is Club America, the high school chapters, and we have one right here in Moore County, and we're going to talk later in this program with two of the young people, homeschooled high school students, who are leading this Club America chapter and sustaining the legacy of Charlie Kirk right here in this community. And that is a conversation that you will not want to miss. They really were certainly an inspiration to me as we talked about the future and their part in it, which will be vital. We begin, as we always do, with public enemy number one. Well, some weeks we have to sort of debate who that should be, but I think this week it was a slam dunk, and I used that pun intentionally, as the public enemy number one dubious distinction goes to the Chicago Bulls of the National Basketball Association, and by extension the NBA itself, which inevitably played a role in what went down, which was the singling out of a single player named Jaden Ivey, who had recently joined the Bulls after being traded from the Detroit Pistons. Jaden has not really had much of an impact on the NBA as of yet because he's had a few physical limitations that he's been working through. But Jaden, like many young 20-somethings in our culture today, took to his social media and decided that, you know, he'd had just about enough of hearing about the NBA hosting the various NBA franchises, hosting these so-called Pride Nights, and I don't have to explain to you what that is. That is, of course, the bowing to the LGBTQ movement, and the NBA feels like they have to participate in that as part of the entertainment that they put on for their fans in their arenas. And that, of course, also bleeds into the month of June, which is Pride Month. You know, Memorial Day gets a day, Pride gets a month. Go figure that out. Jaden Ivey goes on his social media, and he's got a real problem with what he calls the unrighteousness of the NBA's embrace of the Pride culture. Let's play clip one.
That the world can proclaim LGBTQ. Right? They proclaim Pride Month and the NBA. They proclaim it. They show it to the world. They say, come join us for Pride, for Pride Month, to celebrate unrighteousness. They proclaim it. They proclaim it on the billboards. They proclaim it in the streets. Unrighteousness. So how is it that one can't speak righteousness? How is it one that how are they to say that you man, this man is crazy?
Good question, Jaden. Well, it didn't take very long for the Bulls to react to that, which I consider to be not even a rant. It was simply a person sharing how he feels about the intersection of professional basketball and the celebration of a cultural abnormality, I guess you would say. The Bulls terminated his contract, lickety-split, which I'm sure began with a phone call from the NBA front office in New York City. I wouldn't be surprised by that at all. So he is now, at the moment, no longer a part of the NBA. And, you know, that strikes many people as a bit of an overreaction in contrast to, let's just say, the behavior of other professional athletes in recent years, both on and off the field, and the way they have desecrated the American flag, the actual pride in their country, and the way they have conducted themselves away from the game in terms of their conduct, some of which is actually criminal. Why don't we play clip five and hear from Jason Whitlock?
Ivy tapes a couple of live streams and instantly fired for speaking against the Alphabet Mafia.
Right, I haven't been with the team because I've been rehabbing. So how is my conduct detrimental to the team?
Yeah, the gays, lesbians, queers, the silent P, pedophiles, the Black Lives Matter, racial idolaters, they control sports, they control the NBA, they control the NFL. That's why Bad Bunny was doing the halftime show. This is a satanic cult in control of the American sports industry. And now I hope you can see it crystal clear. Is Jaden Ivey perfect? No. But he exists in a demonic, satanic sports league that rejects Christian values.
Jason Whitlock, I think one of the most influential cultural commentators of our time, a guy who started out as a sports writer in Kansas City many years ago, and now is one of the preeminent culture and sports podcasters, along with Stephen A. Smith over at ESPN. And I think Jason nails it right there. Is this Jaden Ivey guy, you know, a perfect role model? Probably not. But why should he be terminated in such a dramatic fashion when we have you know, one example after another of professional athletes behaving very badly? This got the attention of Bobby Burick over at OutKick. Let's play clip two.
So the NBA will take on abusers, bridges, drug doers, all kinds of, but Christianity, that's where they draw the line? Child, please. Jaden Ivey may have things going on in the background. The Chicago Bulls and Jaden Ivey cut bait. Actually, the Chicago Bulls cut bait on Jaden Ivey after he went all religious. Now, look, you got to understand something. I believe there's always a backstory. I don't care what it is because I've lived it. There is always a backstory. But if you look on the surface, Jaden Ivey professing his love for Jesus, professing his faith, on the surface seems like, why wouldn't you want that? I mean, given the fact that the NBA has protected some of the worst human beings in the history of the world, and those are people that aren't even known to the public. Not even going to get into Miles Bridges and the numerous times that he has assaulted or been part of an assault relative to his wife with kids in front. I'm not even going to get into that. Mad Max, how many drug tests can you fail? But I guess what we get really upset about in the world of the NBA is when somebody does conduct detrimental to the team by disparaging the LGBTABCD made up community.
Nailed it. He's exactly right about that. He made reference to Miles Bridges of the Charlotte Hornets. Now, the Hornets stuck with Miles back in 2022. Even after he pleaded no contest to felony domestic violence charges in a L.A. Superior Court and was let off rather scot-free with 3 years of probation, zero jail time. Okay, that's just one example of what Bobby Burak is referring to there, where the NBA has kind of turned a blind eye to conduct that, you know, would get any of us in any other profession, you know, on the streets without a job, and we would be radioactive. We would never, in some cases, ever work again. But that is the double standard world we live in when it comes to professional sports and the woke culture and that little cozy relationship that they have formed. That's public enemy number one, and that segues oh so nicely into our depiction of dubious distinction, public embarrassment, number one, the poster child for embarrassment beyond comprehension goes this week to Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, KBJ, ladies and gentlemen. She's a Supreme Court justice, and yet every time I hear her speaking, in the context of a Supreme Court formal event, hearing testimonies and other things, I can't make a real distinction between whether it's an actual Supreme Court moment or if it's a Saturday Night Live skit. That's how unserious this person is. So of course this week there were oral arguments regarding the matter of birthright citizenship, which has long been a dark cloud hanging over this country, the idea that people from other lands can come here and give birth to children who, upon exiting the womb, are instantly granted citizenship in the United States of America. When you think about it, in the terms that I just described, it's absurd. And yet, no Supreme Court to date has been willing to take up the matter until President Trump put it on the table by passing an executive order, by signing an executive order, I should say, that that makes birthright citizenship null and void. Well, of course, the courts weren't going to have any of that, and that was immediately put on hold by some activist judge. And now it has made its way to the highest court in the land, and I say that with a bit of sarcasm in my voice. So during the arguments this past week, K. Brown Jackson, Ketanji, who during her confirmation hearings was unable to define what a woman is, was now asked to take on this birthright citizenship topic. And it found her mind drifting across the ocean to the Empire of Japan. Let's play clip three.
You obviously have permanent allegiance based on being born in whatever country you're from. That's what everybody recognizes. But you also have local allegiance when you are on the soil of this other sovereign. And I was thinking, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen and visiting Japan. And what it means is that, you know, if I steal someone's wallet in Japan, the Japanese authorities can arrest me and prosecute me. It's allegiance, meaning can they control you as a matter of law? I can also rely on them if my wallet is stolen to, you know, under Japanese law, go and prosecute the person who has stolen it. So there's this relationship based on, even though I'm a temporary traveler, I'm just on vacation in Japan, I'm still locally owing allegiance in that sense. Is that the right way to think about it? And if so, doesn't that explain why both temporary residents and undocumented people would have that kind of quote unquote allegiance just by virtue of being in the United States?
Okay. If anybody can tell me what the heck she's talking about, please, please send me an immediate text and clear it up for me. Because what I'm taking away from that is that, she's using the wallet analogy, which is kind of interesting, because when you think about documented effects of the undocumented flooding into our country as they did by the millions under the Biden regime, one of the effects of that is the picking of the pocket of the U.S. economy. If think of it as one big wallet, and they're dipping into it by virtue of being here as undocumented citizens, and then they leave behind their children who are you know, red, white, and blue, baseball, and apple pie, and able to tap into all the resources that are accorded citizens of this country. The new book that has come out, Invisible Coup, by Peter Schweizer, takes this even further and describes how there's a whole cottage industry in China where parents are enabled to come to the United States for brief periods of time, almost like a quick staycation. They give birth. They stick around just long enough for the child to be deemed an American citizen, and then they head right on back to Beijing and Shanghai and Wuhan and wherever else they're from. And then years from now, their child, their son or daughter, will come waltzing into the United States with the full rights and privileges of a naturalized U.S. citizen. It is absurd. Speaking of Peter Schweizer, he will be here in Moore County coming up very soon as the keynote speaker at the annual Moore County Republican Party Lincoln Reagan Trump dinner on May 12. That's May 12 at the Country Club of North Carolina. And you will be able to hear from Peter Schweizer, who is the author of a number of best-selling books, including one that comes to mind entitled Clinton Cash, which, of course, is self-explanatory. Bill and Hill and their long-time grift as political figures in this country. If you would like to attend the Lincoln Reagan Trump dinner, all you have to do is go to moregop.com, moregop.com, and scroll your way to the events section, and you can buy your tickets online and hear from Peter Schweizer on May the 12th. And I think that will be a very interesting appearance by this very highly regarded investigative reporter. And this book will shake you to your core. I'd like to take a moment to bring to your attention something that I think is important. You know, in this community, we are surrounded by members of the military, and from time to time, we celebrate the sacrifices they have made while wearing the uniform in defense of our nation. One such individual is Garrett Illerbrunn. Garrett was seriously injured during a drone strike in northern Iraq on Christmas Day. And I'm going to just dip into the memory here and tell you that I believe it was 2023. He has gone through years of rehab hell after taking shrapnel to his brain, essentially. Many of us remember last year going out to the harness track here in Pinehurst and watching his final flight as he was ceremoniously lifted above the ground in a helicopter for his farewell flight, and we were all there to honor him. Well, his sister-in-law, Allison Brooks, has maintained a page with updates on Garrett's progress. He has now been transferred to a rehab facility in New Hampshire for an indefinite period of time. And she reminds us all that Garrett's birthday is coming up April 7. So that is very soon. That is next Tuesday, if I have my calendar correct. And she would invite all of us here in Moore County who remember his story and who want to keep him in our prayers and never forget the sacrifice he made. She invites us to go ahead and send him a birthday card. She wants to fill his rehab room with birthday cards in time for his April 7th birthday. And I want you to take a moment and grab your scroll and quill and dip it in the inkwell and write this down. I want you to send a birthday card to Garrett Illerbrunn at 175 Blueberry Lane. Now, that's pretty easy to remember. You know, spring is coming. Blueberry season will be upon us. 175 Blueberry Lane, Laconia, Laconia, New Hampshire, 03246. 03246 is the zip. Laconia is the town. New Hampshire is the state. Garrett Illerbrunn is the hero. So if you have time to shoot him off a birthday card and let him know that here in Moore County, we have not forgotten what he did in defense of our country and the bravery he showed, and that our prayers are still with him as he continues a lifetime, I believe, of rehabilitation from that fateful moment on Christmas Day 2023. Some interesting data this week was forthcoming by a little-known organization out of they're in the business of tracking the domestic migration of Americans as we move throughout the calendar year, and that includes moving within the state of our residence and moving from one state to another. And as we know, in recent years, because of the dysfunction that grips states like California and Illinois and New York, there has been a massive outflow of population from those so-called blue, woke, train wreck, dumpster fire states, which have economies like third world countries and infrastructure to match. This organization delivers us some really interesting data points, which I wanted to share with you. National moving stats, if I can just get my fingers to work here. It's the Hire a Helper Migration Report, the annual deep dive into how, where, and why Americans moved in 2025. Well, the headline number is that 15 million U.S. adults moved in 2025, which sounds like a lot, but it's really obviously a fraction of our population. And 78% of those moves were intrastate, meaning that people moved from like Pinehurst to Southern Pines or Charlotte to Aberdeen, or and unfortunately, a lot of it is into Moore County from places like Charlotte and the Triangle, as we witness with our horror as we fight the endless backups on highways 1 and 5. South Carolina, not North Carolina, which kind of surprised me, led the nation in net migration per capita. And of course, as you might expect, one of the leading factors in influencing people to move, to uproot themselves, is lower cost of living, especially into the Southeast and Mountain West. And so what did we learn about this report? Well, we learned that Texas picked up 68,000 new residents, more than any other state. South Carolina added 41,500. North Carolina added close to 31,000 new residents in 2025, followed very closely by no state income tax, Tennessee with 30,000. And then predictably, California bled 98,000 residents who fled Gavin Newsom as if the entire state was on fire, which during various times of the year it actually is. Next on the list of people running as fast as they can out of a state was New York, the state of New York, where 56,000 people said, "I'm out of here. For the love of God, get me out of here." But the interesting data point to me is that when what they do is they adjust for population size, because obviously the largest states are going to have the biggest outflows and the biggest inflows. But when you take a look at an adjustment for population size, you see a different picture emerging. And by this measure, South Carolina led the nation in 2025 with a net gain of 79.7 residents per 10,000 people. And as this survey points out, that growth is transformative because it can put immediate pressure on housing supply, but it can also accelerate job creation and reshape and invigorate economies, which is certainly true. Now, this surprised me. Following behind South Carolina in the number two slot is Idaho, which added 63 residents per 10,000. Again, people searching for quality of life and this buzzword that everybody is fixated on called affordability, which is probably one of the most worn out terms that we're hearing in recent years. Delaware came in third. Now, I don't know why I would want to move to Delaware, because you might run into Joe and Jill Biden at a cocktail party, and I wouldn't enjoy that very much. But they picked up 54.5 new residents per 10,000. And apparently Delaware is attractive due to its proximity to major East Coast job markets, and that it maintains a comparatively lower cost of living due to the fact that the state has no sales or estate or Social Security taxes. Isn't that interesting that the tax and spend president from Delaware, Joe Biden, comes from a state that doesn't like taxes very much? That's how does that work out for you? But I actually knew a woman back in the day who worked at a network, at one of the networks, I believe it was ABC Sports in New York City, and she commuted by train each and every day from Delaware. And I don't know how she did that. It would have driven me crazy. But rounding out the top five on our migration list here are Tennessee and Alabama. Not terribly a huge surprise. So even though we feel like we're being inundated here in North Carolina, we are not even in the top five based on that metric. But it is, you know, it is interesting to see how these dumpster fire states like California are bleeding population, and you know, eventually the boneheads who are driving them out are going to figure this out, but it takes them a while. You know, they're a little slow. Take, for example, the state of California. You know, we've learned quite a bit about the toll of fraud in Minnesota based on the Somalian mafia that thrives there. But California is emerging as really maybe more of the poster child for how fraud is destroying the economy. A very prominent independent journalist who I follow named Christopher Rufo, R-U-F-O, Rufo, has done a deep dive into what is really going on in California. And he found that though the state collects some of the country's highest income, business, fuel, and other taxes, it spends more than $300 billion per year. And yet, he writes, everywhere you look, California seems to be falling apart. No kidding. I mean, a small fire starts, you know, and the next thing you know, the Pacific Palisades are a smoldering memory, and people are still recovering from that terrible fire. Rufo points out that that roads are crumbling. Obviously, they have a metastasizing drug addiction and homeless problem, especially in parts of Los Angeles and San Francisco. And this is leading Californians to ask, if everything is going to hell in the formerly Golden State, where is all the money going? So Rufo and his team conducted interviews with an array of public officials and fraud experts, political analysts, and then they reviewed hundreds of pages of government reports and state audits, criminal indictments, and other public records. And here's what they discovered, and this is going to blow you away. From unemployment insurance and Medicaid to failed homeless initiatives and welfare programs, seemingly every state program has been compromised by criminals. The best estimate suggests that on the governor's watch, Governor Gavin Newsom, who thinks he's running for president in a couple of years. I mean, are you kidding me? The best estimates suggest that under the governor's watch, fraudsters, scammers, and organized crime rings have stolen at least $180 billion with a B from taxpayers. Now, that kind of makes the Somalians in Minnesota look like amateurs, doesn't it? I mean, they're just nibbling at the edges of fraud. But in California, it is an industry. It is a full-time cottage industry for many, many fraudsters. And when you're draining $180 billion from taxpayers, no wonder they're leaving. No wonder that I know about half a dozen or more couples here in Moore County who came from what we think of tranquil places to live, like San Diego and Los Angeles. They are gone, baby. They are here and loving it and never looking back. The only thing they miss is the occasional, convertible out on the L.A. Highway 1 on the coast of California, maybe, but that is about it. I can assure you of that. And that migration is only going to continue apace, as we like to say. Joining us now are two guests who I'm delighted to have in the studio today. We have Bella Van Cleve. Good morning, Bella.
Morning.
And James Willis. Good morning, James.
Good morning, sir.
These great young Americans are two of the officers in the Club America chapter here in Moore County. Club America is the high school outreach of Turning Point USA, founded by the late Charlie Kirk out in Phoenix, Arizona. And after Turning Point USA started gaining momentum on college campuses over a period of like a decade, which Charlie launched when he was around 18 years old, quite remarkable. He realized that he wanted to expand the scope of Turning Point USA and take it to the high schools. And it was one of his, I guess at the time of his unfortunate passing, it was really one of the new initiatives, new objectives and priorities of Turning Point USA, was to expand what they were doing on college campuses to the high schools. And that is to empower patriotic leaders of tomorrow and train these students to build networks and spearhead impactful initiatives and help students register to vote and learn how to talk about living in a free society. Sounds pretty basic, but you know, the state of public education today, you can't take any of that for granted. And as we speak, the Club America chapter that Bella and James are running here in Moore County, which is primarily focusing on homeschooled high school age students. They are part of a network of more than 1,200 high school clubs across the nation as we speak, with north of 14,000 students participating as part of the expansion of Turning Point USA and the Charlie Kirk legacy to the high schools. So I wanted to just establish, you know, what we're here and talking about this morning. And it really is an incredible development that something that started literally with an idea by an 18-year-old who didn't even attend college, by the way, always bears repeating, that this has grown into this massive national network of future leaders. So, Bella, I wanted you to share with our audience your experience in early on, after your chapter had been formed here in Moore County. You traveled to Phoenix to attend the annual AmeriFest event, which was put on by TPUSA, I think it's maybe twice a year. Mm-hmm. It is massive in scale now, today. It brings in young people from all over the country and people of all ages, really, as well as a incredible roster of speakers and influencers. It had, at the time of Charlie's passing, it had become pretty much a must attend event for people who wanted to be engaged in the movement. So tell us about your experience. You're in Phoenix. You're at this massive event. You're one young lady from Moore County, North Carolina, and what happens?
Yeah, so the chapter was going on for about a year and a half to 2 years now, and I was feeling really discouraged because really nobody was joining our chapter, and I didn't know what to do or where to start from there. And so I got to go to this event because our previous field rep presented it to me. So I flew out there, and Charlie Kirk was there. I got to see him in real life. He was talking amongst... He was in his, like, podcast thing, and, you know, they were asking him questions. So I, made my way through this crowd just to talk to him. And I asked him a question on how can I expand my chapter and how can I get more into my community? And, you know, he gave me advice, and I took it, definitely. And after, I was, like, the most happiest person in the world. I was very, very encouraged. He even gave me a hat with his signature on it. So that was great, great time.
And what some people may not know about Charlie Kirk is that he was one tall guy.
Oh, yeah.
What is he, like 6'7" or something?
Yeah, definitely.
A towering figure, literally and figuratively.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the advice that he gave you about how to expand and how have you put that into practical use?
Well, he told us to keep on posting on social media because, you know, teens are on there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And just to keep on doing activity after activity, just, you know, get people's attention. Attention.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, both of you have been part of this for, what, a couple of years now, this club?
Well, I founded it.
You founded it.
James just joined recently.
Yeah, I just joined in October. It was right after he died. I felt... like the Lord was calling me there.
Mm-hmm.
I had already accepted a call to evangelism, and I said I had never liked politics before I hit my senior year, and I remember when he died, it hit hard. I remember thinking, here's this, what I would like to call an apologist in politics,
mm-hmm.
just passed, and what am I doing to help in a corrupt, what I would like to call a corrupt system most of the time.
Yeah, no, that's a valid point. And, you know, I think one of the brilliant aspects of the Charlie Kirk legacy is that no one was able to thread that needle better than him in terms of the intersection of politics and Christian faith. And he felt that you could be a voice in both of them without giving too much priority to one over the other. But I always remember that during some random podcast by some person who I don't even know, asked him a very simple question. If it all went away tomorrow, you know, what matters most to you? And he said, courage for my faith.
Mm-hmm.
So after all the celebrity that he had achieved, after being invited to Mar-a-Lago to hang out with Donald Trump and Don Jr. and who knows who else, everybody. I mean, he was literally a key figure in the formation of the Trump administration in 2024, leading into 25. There's no question about that. But after all of that, the things that mattered to him most were courage for his faith and, of course, his family. Mm-hmm. And what a great legacy that is, to be able to have that kind of impact and at the end of the day still know why you're doing it, mm-hmm. not to lose touch with that right. original impulse. So now here we are, and how's your club doing? How is your membership? How do you feel about where it's headed and the impact that you're having?
So I feel like we're doing pretty good so far. We're getting a new event pretty soon here. We are getting some interest. I'd like to get definitely some more people up, you know, because people nowadays, teens especially, don't know a lot. And I really want to get out there for the people to understand on why it's important to understand the political system and to why it's important to vote and things like that. Mm-hmm. And social media is very misleading. So especially the things going on right now, TPUSA may look a little wonky, but I want to get out there and have people understand why we're doing it.
And, you know, as homeschooled individuals, you are spared a lot of the noise that students in the public school system hear. Mm-hmm. Some of it deliberate to raise them in an environment where they are groomed to believe that their country is an irredeemable nation, you know, founded on stolen land by white supremacists. Mm-hmm. And that's what they hear from, you know, the time they're in, you know, the first grade. You've been spared some of that. But James, tell us a little bit about why all of this matters. In other words, you know, you can hear the cliche about, you know, the decline of civilization.
Yeah.
And, you know, will we still have a country, you know, 50 years from now, and all those things that every generation talks about. But how are you making a difference, do you think, in the lives of people in your age bracket who are, you know, high school age, looking to their futures?
I think it's just inspiring patriotic students. I think that they don't have, say, they don't really have an organization that they can work with. I think in schools, especially from what I've seen from my friends, they always just, the school system, especially the public education system, kind of just beats them down. Like you said, that this country was just formed on white supremacists who stole the land of indigenous people. And I don't think that's true at all. I think that they saw land that they could cultivate and saw agricultural opportunities, and they seized it. And then they did end up working with indigenous people along the way. And I think there's a lot to talk about in falsehoods in history when it comes to, they paint this bloody picture when there are some really joyous things that came along with it.
Mm. Bella, do you concur with all of that?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I mean, let's face it, the educational industrial complex has been committed for many decades, long before many of us even noticed it, to the degradation of our national legacy, of the foundations on which this country was built. And we didn't really even know it was happening. And then all of a sudden, one day, there's this big, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion bomb that goes off. And we realize that this has all been, you know, brewing under the surface for many years in classrooms, with teachers manipulating curriculum, with instructors omitting certain parts of textbooks in order to drive their own personal narratives to influence the minds of very fungible young people who are like sponges just waiting to be soaked up with what they think is knowledge, which is not always knowledge. It's some often than not indoctrination.
Yeah.
But I think why these chapters matter in our high schools and both on the college campuses and at the high school level is because we can't take for granted any longer that that the story is being told of the greatness of America and how we have been a beacon of hope for generations of people, how this country has changed so many lives, and how we have shown that that freedom is not merely an aspiration, but is something that you can live and breathe as a part of your life, to the point where you get to take it for granted. Not that that's recommended, but that's the beauty of the American experience, is that you can go to school, you can worship on Sundays, you can engage in freedom of speech, you can embrace liberty every waking moment of your life without even having to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it great. So what I find interesting is that even here in Moore County, which is, you know, a pretty Republican-leaning conservative county, if you go by voter registration at least,
mm-hmm.
Not all of the public high schools here have a Club America chapter. Now, why do you suppose that is?
Well, I would say it really just depends on the school. Some is a lack of motivation. Some of the kids, I would say they didn't have the spark of motivation. Maybe they weren't as close to the idea of what Charlie was putting on and always pushing out to the world. Maybe they didn't care as much. Some kids just want to have fun. They want to play sports. They want to participate in clubs. I mean, some of them just want to have the idea of being a kid, not really caring about working towards the freedoms because they think they can just do that later.
Mm-hmm. I think another point is also the public schools, in order to have a Club America in a public high school, you have to have a teacher who is willing to, you know, supervise.
Sponsor and supervise.
Yes.
Yeah.
And people don't really are afraid to stick out on what they believe. And I feel like that is a big part of why we see here in Moore County, why there's less public school club chapters.
Yeah, well, it's a good point. You know, teachers come up through the education system, through the so-called higher education system. And by the time they leave that behind and go to work as a teacher, they're already hardwired to be skeptical of what it is to be an American. So then they go into an environment as public educators. And how many of them want to be the one who comes forward and says, I want to be the sponsor of a Club America chapter on this high school campus? Because they're going to have to face some of these other fellow teachers who find it repulsive that they would participate in any kind of campus activity in which the name of God is spoken and worshiped. That they would find it repulsive that the Constitution of the United States is celebrated. So if you're a 27-year-old teacher trying to make your way in this profession, can you blame them for not wanting to bother with it? I can't.
And I think it's really tragic because, especially with these Christian educators, say a Christian educator who is patriotic and believes in the Constitution, maybe is a constitutionalist, believes in America, but at the same time, I think it's tragic how some of these teachers and educators can call themselves brave when they don't even have the guts to face their colleagues and face their maybe administrative authorities and just be scared and back down and not stand up for what's right and teach these youth real objectives and real ideologies that are going to matter in the future.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think to extend that point, if you look at Charlie Kirk, you know, he was not constrained by his love of country and his his focus on espousing the virtues of this country. Mm-hmm. Nor was he what you would call a religious person to the point where he couldn't engage in the world around him.
Exactly.
He was very adept at that. And by the way, he liked to have fun too. He loved sports. He followed the Chicago Cubs, which mm-hmm. is a very hard thing to do. he had all kinds of outside interests above and beyond. In other words, he didn't live in an echo chamber mm-hmm. of America first and all the things that really mattered to him, but he had a life. And I think that the best thing that you all can do as you recruit into your chapter and other chapters, there's one at Sand Hills Community College as well, a Turning Point USA chapter, mm-hmm. is demonstrate by the way you live and by what your priorities are that this is for normal people, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You don't have to be some kind of political wonky in the weeds person.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a hyper evangelist person.
Yeah.
This is all just what we used to consider being a normal American kid mm-hmm. growing up.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
I agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I started the chapter, I was, kind of normal kid. I was like, I'll just do this because why not? And, along the way, I followed Charlie, and I was like, oh, this is actually really interesting. And I found out a lot of more information of like what I didn't understand before. So it really does help you grow too. So,
and of course, you had parental support, and that always helps too. And we, in society writ large, we don't take that for granted anymore either, because a lot of parents are checked out as well, and they turn everything over to the public education system.
Right.
And like that's really going to turn out well. But, I really can't thank both of you enough for coming in today and talking about what you've been doing in terms of your connection to the Charlie Kirk legacy and the Club America network of high school students across the country. And I just want to wrap this up by hearkening back to that Sunday, a week or so after Charlie was assassinated, a gathering in the heart of the village of Pinehurst. Mm-hmm. It was a late Sunday afternoon, September probably 20th, somewhere in there. A lot of people could have been doing many other things, watching NFL games, whatever, you name it. And they assembled in that village green, and it blew me away, actually, who was there and the different faces I recognized, and you were there as well, Bella.
Yep.
What was that experience like? I mean, you were surrounded by all these people who were in mourning mm-hmm. and yet full of hope.
Yeah, it was really inspiring and very supportive, I would say. It was last minute that I got called to come and speak, but I was very much willing. I really wanted to get out there in the community and to speak on the tragic event that went down, and just to give people hope that we will continue Turning Point in our chapter, especially to fight for what's right, because what happened to Charlie was not right.
Yeah, to say the least. Well, again, thank both of you for coming in. You are an inspiration to me, and let's stay in touch, and I wish you all the best going forward.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
We are winding down another episode of Taking Aim, and I want to thank all of you for joining us, and I want to pause to wish you a blessed Easter Sunday and a wonderful time of reflection and worship with your family, and we will look forward to having you join us again next week right here on your favorite Saturday morning program, Taking Aim. I'm Steve Woodward. Have a great weekend.